Mosity.com.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper recovering from a serious back injury, and we can only wish him well and really hope to have him back very soon. So why has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder become such an epidemic in the U.S.? Rates of diagnosis and treatment now cited as 1 in 9 children and adolescents are still on the rise. And in some southern states, boys over 9 years of age are diagnosed at rates of almost 1 in 3. Joining us now are the co-authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. Stephen Hinshaw, PhD, is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Well, thank you for being here. Also joining us is Richard Scheffler, PhD. He's a distinguished professor of health economics and public policy, also at UC Berkeley. Good afternoon and welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
So I have lots of questions, gentlemen, for both of you, and please feel free to address your area of expertise because it seems like they cross over quite a bit. So let's just start. You've both chronicled this explosion in the U.S. over the last few decades. So is it an overdiagnosed condition at this point, or are we just seeing more of it? Is it just growing in the United States right now?
So the answer might be C on a multiple choice test, both of the above.
Okay.
In some ways, this is an okay thing. Maybe the medical profession is catching up with the recognition of the reality of ADHD. This is a serious condition when it exists in kids, adolescents, or adults. It takes away from academic potential, can lead to serious accidental injuries, impaired social relationships, and vocational performance. But on the other hand, over the last 9 years, a 41% to 42% increase in diagnosis across the country with, as you pointed out, some huge geographical variability, it doesn't seem as though that's totally an increase in the real condition. We might say that's an increase in diagnosed prevalence. And so one of the missions we undertook in the ADHD explosion was to figure out what's real about this explosion and what might be driving this incredible rate of diagnosis. And we'll be glad to talk about that.
Okay. This actually begs the question of how diagnosis is actually made. Who's doing this evaluating, by what means, and are there guidelines for diagnosis that are used consistently, or is this just purely subjective?
Well, the good news is that official guidelines are now published, and they're quite good. The ACAP, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, have both in the last few years published very thorough guidelines for what you need to do to diagnose. You've got to get a thorough history from the family. Maybe this is trauma or abuse. Maybe you need a medical rule out. Maybe this is a seizure disorder. You need to get really good information from the child's school, not just this year's teacher, but a past teacher or two. You need to get checklists that have national norms built in, so it's not just guesswork and subjective. That's the standard. The problem is many clinicians out there aren't trained in those standards, and even if they are and want to take the couple of hours that's needed, maybe there's not reimbursement to do that. So, Richard, you might want to talk about that because that's a policy issue.
Right.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate part is that the healthcare system has not recognized the seriousness of the diagnosis. Once a child is diagnosed, of course, it changes their life significantly. There's stigma, there's things that happen in school, and on average, 70% of them receive some kind of medication, Adderall, Ritalin, or Concerta. These are very powerful drugs. So the rate of reimbursement is just inadequate. This is often, it can be done sometimes in a pediatrician's office in 10 minutes. This quick and dirty diagnosis is, I think, really dangerous. We need to spend more money and more time to do the diagnosis properly. And in the long run, we'll save a lot of money because treating this child for 10 or 15 years is a huge investment of the healthcare system, but also the time and energy of the parent. So You know, we are worried about that. It's, you know, spend a little bit more money now and save a lot more money down the road.
Well, now, Stephen Hinshaw, you mentioned that, you know, it could be abuse, it could be something else. So let's, if we can, what are the symptoms of ADHD and what other problems could there be that are really not ADHD but are being diagnosed as that?
Well, it's a huge question, and we could take the whole rest of the program going through it. But let's be somewhat brief. There's two main classes or clusters of symptoms. One is in the area of inattention and disorganization. These are kids who don't appear to listen. They've got good hearing, but they're not following directions. Organizational problems. Not following through on the commands that they hear. That's one symptom cluster. The other is impulsive and hyperactive behaviors. This is blowing out the birthday candles at the birthday party, but it's not your birthday, it's your friend's birthday, but it just seems so enticing with those candles flowing. And sometimes fidgeting and squirming, sometimes running around the room. So if you have high levels of either or both of these symptoms that are well above norms for a kid your age, and if these symptoms are causing significant academic impairment, social impairment, and if you've ruled out that this is potentially the result of trauma, or this is a very depressed kid, one of the symptoms of depression is poor concentration, or again, other neurological conditions might mimic this, it takes some sorting out to do what we call rule-out diagnoses, but we also know that a child or adolescent might have ADHD, but on top of it, have significant anxiety or learning problems. So part of the assessment is to look at the whole child, not just the inattention and impulsivity, but what other conditions deserve treatment too. To do this in 10 or 12 minutes is absurd, to be quite honest. You can't do it adequately, and two things might happen. You can quickly overdiagnose because it looks like, smells like ADHD. But sometimes this leads to underdiagnosis too, because the clinician says, well, I don't see her running around the waiting room, or the parents say he can play video games for 5 consecutive hours. It can't be ADHD. You've got to get information from the classroom, from the soccer field, from the workplace to make a thorough diagnosis.
Now, what are some of the dangers of being undiagnosed? I would think also that does underdiagnosis occur in certain populations?
Yes, there's definitely underdiagnosis in certain populations. Interestingly enough, if you go back more than a decade, you would have seen in the data a big black-white differential in the diagnosis of ADHD. But with the current data now, that's virtually disappeared. They're about almost the same, though there is state-by-state variation. We see lower diagnosis in Hispanic populations. We're in California. We see a lot of that. I wouldn't be surprised if the Cuban population had the same in Florida, and also the Asian population. So there is a bit of a cultural acceptance of the diagnosis and the parents' trigger to have their kids looked at and what they're willing to tolerate as part of parenting. So there's definitely a cultural aspect to this diagnosis.
And what about gender differences? That statistic, 1 in 3 boys in southern states, and I'd like to talk about the geographic differences as well, but what about between boys and girls?
So the rule of thumb is the first 10 years of life are the risk period for boys for all sorts of neurological and psychiatric conditions. Boys have autism spectrum disorders at least 5 to 1 over girls, serious aggressive conduct problems. For ADHD, it's about 3 to 1. This isn't just a bias. The first 10 years of life are hard for boys' slower maturing brains. The second 10 years of life are the trouble spot for girls with all of the problems of adolescence.
Right.
But we used to think that ADHD didn't exist in girls, and only recently have clinicians been looking at the science and realizing that, yeah, a girl can have this diagnosis too. Right here in Berkeley, my research team has been following the largest sample of girls with ADHD that we know of in the world. They participated in our summer camps 15 years ago. We followed them right through childhood and adolescence and young adulthood. And these girls with ADHD, not only just like boys, continue to have academic and social problems, but these girls are at terribly high risk as they reach their late teen years for cutting, self-mutilation, suicidal behaviors. It's a big toll to have ADHD when you're a girl because these symptoms aren't very typical of girls, and there's a lot of stigma involved.
I can comment a little bit, if you'd like, on the geographic issues.
What is this with the southern states? Is it about the education, the education requirements?
I think it has to do with fried chicken and grits, maybe, or something like that. I don't know. But no, I actually know the South pretty well. My first teaching job was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, so I lived there. No, it's a, quite an it's probably one of the big ahas in our book. Because we looked around to try to explain that 40% spike in diagnosis in the last 9-10 years that Steve talked about is kind of, you know, it's mind-boggling, and we couldn't find anything in the healthcare system, the reimbursement system. There's obviously, this is not a contagious disease. It's not spreading that way. So exactly what is going on? So we puzzled in Berkeley for a few years, and finally the map of the country did it. We're looking at a map with our research group, and we see this enormous variation in rates, and particularly the South is high over time, and so we actually, to explain this, did a pairwise comparison, though we looked at all of the states in the South between North Carolina and California, and the rates in North Carolina are more or less twice what they are in California, so exactly what's going on.
Right.
So we searched around, and we ended up with education policy. So I can start the story a little bit and then have Steve. This is a big, important thing for our book, and the closest thing to a smoking gun. It's causing a lot of interest around the country. Steve and I have had op-ed pieces, of course, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal about this issue. So it's important to understand. And in the 1990s, the test scores became more important, and they were lower, more or less, in many of the southern states, math and reading scores for kids leaving high school. And so the states there adopted what's called school accountability laws early on. So they changed the way they financed the schools, and instead of just giving the school budget based on the number of students or student-teacher ratios, they said, we're going to give you budgets based on how well the kids do when they graduate. Graduation rates, but also test scores, math and reading and other kinds of scores. So more or less 30 states did that, 20 didn't. And more of them did it in the South and did it earlier. Later on, President Bush extended this with his No Child Left Behind policy. If you wanted federal funds, you had to provide test scores as well. And so the other 20 states adopted that. And he had a special focus on the particularly kids in poor areas and poor neighborhoods. So just to end the storyline, we analyzed this. We explained it to parents and teachers who read this book. But the big aha is the southern states showed over this period of time a spike in rates of, compared to other states who didn't adopt this, of more than 60%. So basically, our storyline, it has to do with education, and that's why the tagline of the book is the push for performance.
I'm wondering how these Common Core standards might affect everything now that have been implemented, I think, in 44 states and the District of Columbia.
Right. So it's very interesting. With No Child Left Behind, as Richard was saying, the 20 states that hadn't passed these accountability laws suddenly, because of federal statute, became accountability states too. And it was in those states, largely outside the South, that within a couple of years after No Child Left Behind, we found another spike in diagnosis in these additional states. Now, that abated after 2009, because Obama was elected, the race to the top replaced No Child Left Behind, and the policies changed. But now, as you point out, we've got Common Core. If you're a parent of a kid in school, and our youngest is a fifth grader, I would conservatively say that many of the parents of the fifth graders at Evans School are puzzling over Common Core. How do you think through the solutions to these math problems and all the grammar that's needed, et cetera, et cetera? And it may be that this is another big push for performance. Of course, the other big issue these days is mandatory preschool, pre-kindergarten, transitional kindergarten. These are good things, in my opinion. We need better standards for teaching. But one of the unintended consequences may be that as more and more kids not subject to these standards are now put under these standards with these quick and dirty 10-minute diagnoses, will we see another spike in ADHD diagnoses? Because that's the reason that some kids aren't conforming and aren't performing up to standards. So any policy has what we call intended effects and unintended effects, and we want to make sure that the right diagnostic practices are in place so that the proper kids get diagnosed with ADHD and get the services needed, but that we don't start to see a third, a half of all kids get this label. The rates are going up so fast now that, at least in some regions, that's not out of the question.
We have an emailer, and I am going to open the phones and the email, but we got this one in early from Alyssa, who says she was a teacher for years. I saw teachers of children of all socioeconomic levels recommend testing meant to lead to medication. Have you also found teachers needing to deal with students by medicating them? And I'm assuming she means medicating them for ADHD.
Right. So it's very interesting. We talked about accountability laws and push for performance and test scores. Starting in 2001 in Connecticut, and since that time, 13 other states have adopted such laws, a different kind of legislation has been promoted and passed in some states that essentially outlaws teachers and school personnel from raising the issue of medication with a family. In other states, this has been extended to the statute that a district can't hold a family on a neglect charge for failing to medicate their kid as a condition of coming to school. So these anti-medication laws, if you want to call them that, very interestingly, against this rise of over 40% in ADHD diagnosis in most of the country in the last decade, in the states with those laws, the rate of rise of diagnosis has been a flat 0%. Mm. So we believe that teachers and school personnel need to communicate with families about attention problems, behavior problems, learning problems, but teachers are not the ones to recommend medication. So depending on your feelings and attitudes, these laws may be appropriately restricting teaching personnel from raising medication, but we certainly don't want to prohibit discussion about kids' learning styles and problem behaviors from occurring. It's in fact one of the evidence-based treatments for ADHD over and above medication is these kinds of behavioral programs that get parents and teachers together to figure out the right reward system for a kid. So we don't want to discourage that kind of communication.
I was going to ask you about that. I want to get to the medications and also the alternative methods or behavioral cognitive methods, but we need to take a break on today's Topical Currents. We are speaking about ADHD with the authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. That's Stephen Hinshaw, PhD, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. Richard Scheffler, PhD, distinguished professor of health, economics, and public policy at the School of Public Health and Public Policy, also at UC Berkeley. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
Gallery Night Live is this Friday at the Coral Gables Museum. With free admission and two new exhibits, Capture Coral Gables and 12 Stadiums, 12 Cities, plus a live performance by the Rose Max Samba Band and Gallery Night Kids Club. Details at coralgablesmuseum.org.
Hi, my name is Michael Stock.
I'm Karen Neal. We host The Public Storyteller.
Every Sunday at 4 o'clock, we want to hear stories from you.
Stories that took place in South Florida.
I had mostly domestic birds, but I got involved in wildlife rescue kind of as a quirk. I would find little animals and bring them home, and my mother would say, "Now you're bringing home another animal."
Tune in Sunday at 4 for The Public Storyteller.
City Theater invites playwrights, theater artists, and educators to City Rights, a conference designed for playwrights. City Rights runs June 26th through 29th at the Epic Hotel. There will be writing workshops, panels, networking, and more. Details at citytheater.com or 305-755-9401.
This is Friends of WLRN President and CEO Victor Kendall. If WLRN has been important to you, please consider a planned gift through our Legacy Society program. Information is available at wlrn.org/planned giving. And thank you.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. We are speaking about ADHD with the authors of a new book, The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. The authors are Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, where he was department chair for 7 years and vice chair of psychiatry at UC San Francisco, and the author of hundreds of publications and 10 books. Also, Richard Scheffler, PhD, Distinguished Professor of Health Economics and Public Policy at the School of Public Health and Public Policy, UC Berkeley, also the author of nearly 200 publications and 10 books. You're keeping neck and neck with each other, gentlemen, I see.
That's Berkeley.
Oh, okay. I'm going to open the phones. If you have an experience as a teacher with students with ADHD, if your child's been diagnosed, if you're wondering if you should test your child, if you have it or you think you might, whatever your situation, you're welcome to join in the conversation. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Before we get to the medications and alternative treatments, is ADHD a biological condition? Is there a genetic predisposition to it? Is it a disease or a disorder? Or is it a social or cultural phenomenon?
Well, this is one of the problems that we tackle head-on in the book. In fact, the genetic liability for ADHD is higher than the genetic liability for depression or schizophrenia. Even though we all think, oh, it's the parenting you receive that helps you focus or not, it's really the genes that are transmitted from parent to child that put you somewhere on the bell curve of ultra-focus and conscientiousness to being kind of scattered and getting distracted by anything that comes down the environmental pike. So genes matter a lot. There's other causes of this condition, like being born at a very low birth weight, if the mother ingests substances during pregnancy for the in utero fetus and embryo. These are risks as well.
What kind of substances? Excuse me.
So the best data are on alcohol and tobacco.
I see.
Other substances may be related, but they're hard to tease apart because many women who are using drugs during pregnancy are using multiple, so it's hard to tease that apart. But the point I was going to make is that even though the underlying biology is clearly real, it's how you're schooled and how you're parented that helps you adjust or not. So we want to take the blame off of parents. Parents typically don't cause ADHD, except maybe through some of the genes they transmit. But how you respond, being regular, non-emotional in your discipline, setting regular rewards, having good communication with school, can make all the difference for outcome. So in the book, The ADHD Explosion, we argue that ADHD is 100% biological and 100% contextual and cultural and familial too. They both go together. And as we've pointed out, the spike in diagnosis isn't because genes have mutated in the last 10 years. That would defy Darwin. It's because these pressures are eliciting these underlying tendencies at unprecedented rates.
What about just our culture of being so high-tech and digitized? And is that having, do you think that's causing more of it? Or does that mean that somebody who's predisposed would be more obviously ADHD? Could it be our culture?
Yeah, I think there is a cultural aspect to this, particularly in the workplace. We're seeing now the next wave of increase in diagnoses is in middle-aged adults and in the workplace. And I think part of that has to do with the kind of jobs we have, you know, the white-collar skilled jobs in front of a computer screen and that laser focus, and also you know, trying to do five or six things at the same time, multitasking, and always having your phone there.
Right.
And so, you know, so adults who had this, and by the way, they had it all their life. This is a chronic disease, so it didn't come about. They had it as a child. It was just undiagnosed and probably untreated. But now with the workplace, definitely has changed. And what we see and what we document in the book and we try to explain to parents and to the schools is there's competition in the job market now. It's a global world. We know that. And our students here at Berkeley just don't compete with Stanford students for the jobs at Google and Apple and Facebook. They're competing with bright students from all over the world. So the competition to excel and to do well in school and job performance has never been greater. So I think this adds to the pressures, and we see the diagnosis, and it's a change in the workplace and the environmental fit that I think we're now recognizing and seeing more ADHD.
I'm going to add one thing to this. It seems as though, well, maybe all of us are less attentive than our parents and grandparents were. What's the average news spot clip demands 5 seconds of attention.
Exactly.
And all the social media and constant competition for our attentional resources. But that's not the cause of ADHD. That might help reveal it.
Okay.
But then you could say, but wait a minute, people with ADHD are fast taskers. They're the people who can play video games really well and attend to many things at once and aren't so focus. Well, it's very interesting. If you actually look at the data from a couple of key studies, people with ADHD look like they're super good at video games and electronic media and get really immersed in it, maybe even hyper-focused. But actually, they're not performing as well as people without ADHD, even though in some ways it seems as though they're kind of born to be on these devices. So our culture is changing its attentional demands on all of us, but I think that's revealing the underlying vulnerability rather than causing the condition in the first place.
I see. Also, I forgot to give out the email. The email is radio@wlrn.org, should you prefer to send an email. We have lots of calls, but before we go to the calls, let's start a little bit talking about the medications. What percentage of those diagnosed are treated with some of these medications?
So the most recent data, the national data, the Centers for Disease Control now studies and tracks ADHD and learning problems and autism. It's not just infectious diseases. And so from the latest data that were released just last year, parents around the country, and this isn't just at clinics, this is a representative sample. These are the parents who say it's now 1 in 9 kids of all kids between 4 and 17. And parents also said, if my kid is diagnosed, there's a 70% chance that he or she is receiving medication. So back a few decades ago, maybe a quarter of kids diagnosed. Then it went up to half. Now it's over 2/3. So medication has been spiking in the same way that the diagnosis has.
Okay. Now, is that because it's needed, or is it because of big pharma and advertising and marketing? What's causing the big spike in medication?
So we talk about this and think about this a lot in the book, too. Let's go first things first. The medications for ADHD for a carefully diagnosed person can be enormously beneficial. About 80% of such individuals have a really good response, and the response on placebo is between 10 and 15%. That's the biggest gap in all of psychiatry. These medications are powerful and can be quite helpful, not just for behavior, but for academic performance. You might think, well, why would a stimulant medication help somebody with ADHD? They're already sped up.
Right.
These medications help the release of dopamine. People with ADHD may, in fact, be kind of under-aroused at the level of their brain, and the medications kind of keep their arousal up, so they're fidgeting and squirming less. So, Richard, maybe you want to take it from here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But in the United States, one of the two countries in the world where we allow direct consumer advertisement for medical products, and particularly pharmaceuticals, New Zealand, I think, is the other. It's a rare situation. It's happened in the United States in the last 25, 30 years. And so pharma companies do advertise these drugs, there's no doubt, these medications, I should say. And Steve and I, in the book, we show some of the ads. We particularly, the ads are all over now, of course, they're on TV. There's radio spots for it as well, but we focused on the advertisements in parent magazines like Good Housekeeping, for example, or the typical parent magazines, and looked at the sales of these magazines and the advertisements for these drugs. And clearly, when a pharmaceutical company is coming up with a new drug or even a drug with a new time release, something new in the market, you see the spike up of these ads. That's a good thing and a bad thing. The argument for allowing the advertisement is to give parents information so they know about new things and they can ask their physician or clinicians about it. The bad thing is, so as we point out in the book, a lot of these advertisements and the pictures that we show of them can be misleading. They can be emotionally charged. They can make a parent think that their child needs to be medicated. And so we're concerned about that. The FDA that monitors these things has time in and time out sanctioned and stopped pharmaceutical companies from putting in certain kind of ads that are certainly misleading and often give parents the wrong impression. These medications are not smart pills. They will not make your kid smarter. And that's often the impression that they will give in these magazines. So, Steve, you look at them as well, and you have other impressions.
Right. I mean, you could say on the one hand, these direct-to-consumer ads, that's the best antidote to stigma we've got. I'm talking about it. There's an ad for bipolar medications or depression medications, ADHD medications. We're out of the closet with this.
Right.
But the other hand, as Richard just pointed out, maybe this is disease-mongering, and we're going to find treatment because we know our kid has this disease because we saw it on television or in the newspaper. I want to point out, too, that the medications, as effective as they can be for a carefully diagnosed individual, almost always need to be supplemented by what we call behavior mod-type treatments, where you're providing more regular rewards, less emotional discipline style at home. The teacher is learning to prompt the kid, small steps of learning. Parents and teachers communicate and collaborate on goals. The medicines don't teach skills. There's no skills with pills, as is sometimes said. When you get this combined approach, you get the brain more prepared for learning, and now you've got some procedures in place to promote academic and social skills. So it's a mistake to think that medications are the panacea.
Okay.
They provide much help in many cases, but they're not the full story.
So they need additional therapies needed to work hand in hand with the medications.
Right, right.
What about
I think it's not only, only the therapy. I think you need what we call, the usual team approach. You know, football games are not won only by the quarterback. So you need the parent involved. You need the school involved. And you need behavioral therapy and you need medication. You need the full package, and that will provide the best chance for your child in life. And that's what parents want. They want the best chances for their child. And all of that together, we've seen amazing outcomes of kids who get that full package and amazing results for their life. And that's what every parent wants.
I wanted to ask about natural remedies, but Skip's been waiting for a long time, although I think we did talk about this. But Skip, welcome to Topical Currents. Skip, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, you're on Topical Currents.
Hi, thank you, Bonnie.
Hi. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your guest. You're very so right. Bonnie more or less took half of my questions, but I like to, I've had to rephrase my questionings and turn them upside down. You've been focusing on kids and teens, which need a second pair of eyes to say, okay, this individual has attention deficit disorder. What about if we move from that age group, say from the 20s, 25s to 30s, do persons that have this condition self-diagnose and recognize this? That's my first question.
Okay, let's start with that because we have lots of callers, Skip. Go ahead.
This is Steve. And so lots of adults these days see these ads. There's ADHD in adult stories in the newspaper and on TV and say, well, wait a minute, maybe this is why I've had relationship problems and why my work history is more checkered than I would like. If you go to a clinician to try to sort this out, the clinician would be very well advised to get a thorough history from you, as Richard pointed out earlier. ADHD doesn't, you don't wake up one day at age 40 with ADHD unless you've had some kind of a head injury. There's been a history of this, even though it might not have been detected. So the clinician's going to want to get a thorough history and also talk with your partner, your employer. If your parents are still around and alive, or at least get school records, you need to put together the past and the present. And it's often the case that adults with ADHD know they're suffering and know there's problems, but need additional informants, we call it, in the clinical process to get the full picture.
There's another side to this story, of course. It is now a recognized, of course, disability, particularly if it hurts your employment chances in the marketplace. And so the Social Security Administration, we know about Social Security taking care of the elderly, but it also takes care of the disabled. And if you qualify having a serious enough case of ADHD that affects your job performance, you can collect disability payments, which can be $2,000-$3,000 a month, depending on how severe it is and other factors. So unfortunately, there is public policy also pushing adults and others to look for this diagnosis.
Mm. Okay, Skip?
And I appreciate both of those answers very well. And my last question will be real quick. When you say clinicians, how do I look that up in a hospital directory? Do I look for psychiatrists, psychologists, primary care physicians? I mean, how do I, clinicians is a big word.
Okay.
It is a big word. And so I'm going to kind of cut to the chase and give some advice. Most kids treated for ADHD are treated by pediatricians. There's not enough specialist child and adolescent psychiatrists to go around. Most adults are treated by general practitioners. There's not enough adult psychiatrists or clinical psychologists to specialize around. What you want to do is, wherever you live, talk to the advocacy groups, the self-help groups. Talk to other parents. Talk to other adults. Who are the clinicians in your area, whatever their specific discipline, who do a really good, careful job of diagnosing ADHD? You're not going to get that from a directory. You got to go by word of mouth.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both of you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And Doris in Miami, before we go to our break, Doris, welcome to Topical Currents.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I was calling to comment on something that I heard earlier regarding the disparities between, boys and girls. I've also noticed that I'm a social worker. I've been practicing social work in Miami for approximately 15, 17 years now. And I worked in the foster care system for about 10 of those years. And what I did notice, though, that was when I had first graduated from school and was practicing social work, and what I would notice was an obvious disparity between the number of children that were in the foster care system that were being diagnosed and receiving medication for ADHD and the number of kids in just the regular population. I started to see a correlation between the kids' behavior, obviously, and their, maybe the kids that were having a lot more other difficulties in their own, personal lives, and the increase in, so rapidly they would be diagnosed and they would be treated immediately with medication. And I often felt that there was, like a bit of a rush, I guess, to treat these kids as opposed to the other kids, who were not in the foster care system, and sometimes their parents were very hesitant to go along with the medication or the recommendation for medication.
Okay, let's let our guests comment on that. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, this is Steve, and I'm a clinical and developmental psychologist. Maybe I can answer that best. If you really think about it, what are the risk factors for ADHD? Genetic vulnerability, low birth weight, prenatal substance abuse, sometimes abject poverty. And these are some of the risk factors that place kids at risk for going into foster care or adoption. Many kids who've been through multiple foster homes have a lot of problems. It's easy to think, oh my gosh, they're not very attentive. We should diagnose them with ADHD, get them medications. That may be the tip of the iceberg. It may be that abuse and trauma are the better explanatory factors. It may be that there's severe depression, bipolar disorder, but ADHD is kind of the diagnosis du jour. It's a fairly easy one to give. It should take longer than it does. There's medications and can treat it. And we actually have in our book, in front of almost every chapter, cases. And these are composites from the people we've worked with over the years. And we talk about the case of little Tommy, multiple foster homes, difficult early upbringing in the foster care system before he was adopted. And he got a quick and dirty diagnosis of ADHD, but there were many other problems that were much more significant. And in fact, for kids who really have multiple problems, the simple ADHD treatments are usually not very sufficient. So it's another example of where the diagnosis is out there, it's readily available, but you've got to do a thorough evaluation to sort out what's ADHD, what's trauma, what's depression, and what are a whole host of other factors too.
Okay, Doris, thank you very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Okay, we need to take a break on Topical Currents. We're speaking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with the authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance. That's Dr. Stephen Hinshaw and Dr. Richard Scheffler. We'll be right back.
Orchestra Miami presents Masonic Mozart, June 8th at the Scottish Rite Masonic Temple in downtown Miami, featuring an all-Mozart program led by Artistic Director Elaine Rinaldi. Tickets and information at orchestramiami.org or 305-274-2103.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. 50 years ago this week, this song hit the top of the charts. We'll speak with the group that made it famous.
It surpassed everybody on the chart and knocked the Beatles out of first place.
The Dixie Cups, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next at 2 o'clock here on WLRN.
Area Stage Company presents Title of Show, featuring Broadway star Jody Langle. The award-winning show tells the story of two struggling writers who hear about a new musical theater festival. The submission deadline is 3 weeks away. With nothing to lose, the pair decides to create something new with the help of their friends. Sly, sassy, and inspired, writes Entertainment Weekly, May 23rd through June 8th at Area Stage in Coral Gables. Tickets at 305-666-2078 or areastagecompany.com.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, and we're discussing attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, with Drs. Stephen Hinshaw and Richard Scheffler, the authors of The ADHD Explosion, Myths, Medication, Money, and today's Push for Performance. And we'll have links, of course, to the book on our website. Jessie from Miami says she has a question as to where the best place to find resources, a directory of sorts, for behavioral therapy for children. She says her child is taking medication, but how does she find a reliable place to enroll her child in behavioral therapy, and will insurance companies cover the cost?
So the answer is, like with a caller before the break, just looking up in the white or yellow pages lists of clinicians doesn't really tell you. Advocacy groups, support groups, CHADD, CHAD, ADDDA, Attention Deficit Disorder Association of America, have websites, have national and regional offices. You can talk with other families. You can talk with other adults about who the clinicians are in the area who really do this well. There's, sadly, a dearth of clinicians out there who really know these behavior therapy procedures well. Some regions of the country, they're loaded with them. Others, not so much. But you've got to kind of get word of mouth, talk to people who will vouch for this is the kind of whole child multimodal approach that works. And just a simple directory doesn't really do that. So I would encourage any listeners and callers and emailers to, wherever you live, find the advocacy groups and be in touch with other families. They're going to give you the best information.
And what were those websites?
So CHADD, CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD, and ADDA, ADDA, Attention Deficit Disorder Association of America.
Okay, and those are both .org or .com?
I believe that's
okay, we'll
right.
Check into that, and we'll have links on our website. We have one more emailer who says, she was self-diagnosed years ago and helped her recognize the behavior and realize she wasn't crazy. Why are there so few clinical trials for adults? As an adult without insurance, how would I go about getting an official diagnosis and then treatment? Or at this point, should I just ride the storm out at the age of 48?
I'm just wondering why this adult doesn't have insurance with Obamacare. If the adult is very poor, obviously they could qualify for some kind of state assistance on Medicaid. And, of course, Obamacare gave them a huge subsidy. So I'm disappointed she hasn't taken that up on the healthcare system, because I think if she had the insurance, in fact, it would pay for the diagnosis and the medication and the treatment. That would be my first advice, yes.
Although the Medicaid in particular will more readily pay for medication than for the behavior therapies and for adults' cognitive behavioral therapies. And we need to promote these holistic approaches, these multimodal approaches, and that'll be our next project, to take on the insurance system so that all treatments are reimbursed.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, if the Affordable Care Act is going to cause another spike in diagnoses, because now some people who previously had no insurance are going to have it and can get diagnosed.
I think that's true. I think that is the case. I do expect to see that happen, and we do document that in the book and look at it. It's not as big as the education effect that we talked about, the 60% spike, but when you have 10 or 15 million more people with health insurance and more on Medicaid programs, programs for the poor, some states have expanded those and some have not. So the answer is yes. I think it will feed in that direction. At the end of our book, written for parents, teachers, social workers, and public policy people as well, and healthcare system insurance executives, we do blue sky. Steve and I get together and we say, what do we think is going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years on rates going up and down? And one of the things that obviously would spike it up essentially would be Obamacare. And I don't think it'll be huge, but I think it will be noticeable. New medications coming online, definitely will have do that. And of course, the adult rate going up significantly now, really significantly, and will also do that. And Steve has some reservations on things that would mitigate that.
Okay.
Yeah, it may be that what some of these last callers and emailers have been talking about, the lack of really well-trained clinicians out there may put sort of a ceiling on how much demand there can really be for a condition that can't be treated. And as the information from Centers for Disease Control and in the ADHD explosion gets promoted, are we really going to tolerate one boy in four or even three in some of the southern states getting ADHD diagnoses? Maybe we'll come to our senses and demand the kinds of thorough assessments to get the people diagnosed and treated who need it, but not promote medications as smart pills for all of the United States.
And we have Joyce in Miami, who's been waiting a long time. Joyce, good afternoon.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. I'm the parent of two teenagers, a girl and a boy. They were parented exactly the same way, as you know. The girl is not, top of her class or anything, but because she's able to put forth the effort at school, she does very well and gets very good grades. My son, on the other hand, has always had ADHD since he was very young. I mean, the very first time a teacher approached me about this issue, he must have been, 4 or 5. He's very, very bright. So if he takes, the state assessment test, such as in Florida, it's called the FCAT, he always scores easily the highest of the school.
Joyce, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're very short on time at this point. So if you could ask the doctors your question, it would be great.
Yes. What recommendations do the doctors have for working within the public school system? Even though we are able to make plans and have 504 plans and all kinds of different interventions, it's very, very challenging to ensure continuity when a teacher has 300 or 400 students that he or she must deal with. It's very, very difficult to have a close feedback loop with the parent and to ensure that every teacher applies you know, the same consequences, the same feedback, the
right.
same rewards.
Okay, let's see what they have to say, because we're short on time, Joyce.
So not only does the teacher have hundreds of kids throughout a day, but the kid with ADHD has got six or seven teachers through a day.
Exactly.
Teacher one says the homework's on the board. Teacher two says it's online. Teacher three says, I don't write it down. You've got to listen. And the kid's got to find the backpack and keep everything organized. So it's hard enough for a grade school kid to get an IEP or a 504 plan and get everybody on board, and it's much more difficult in high school. So parents have to be really strong advocates and let the school know that this isn't coddling, this isn't an excuse, that even though for a very bright kid, and we know that very bright people with ADHD are impaired by their ADHD, it's not just a hidden gift at those times. So you've got to kind of do double duty to get teachers on board, the appropriate accommodations made, and the parents have to really dog the system to make sure that everybody's in line on that. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been quite a challenge. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Well, good luck, and thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
And an emailer, we have so many calls and emails we're not going to get to, but Robin wanted me to tell you that many people can't buy the Affordable Care Act insurance either because they don't have enough money. Does that mean they might be eligible for Medicaid?
Yeah, I think it depends on the state and the income levels. I haven't looked at it in Florida, and I think Florida is one of the states that's considering not expanding. So it's a very complicated thing. It depends on your income.
Right.
And there are formulas. The answer is possibly.
Yeah.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about some promising news about this, but we have run out of time. We've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Hinshaw, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, Dr. Richard Scheffler, distinguished professor of health economics and public policy at the School of Public Health and Public Policy at UC Berkeley, and they've authored The ADHD Explosion: Myths, Medication, Money, and Today's Push for Performance, and we will have links on our website to the sites that they mentioned. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be on.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that does wrap up our program for today. Thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And as I said, links to the show also at our Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents will have an interview by literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez, who speaks with celebrated Haitian writer Edwige Dantica, and Linda Gassenheimer serves up Brazilian fare just ahead of the World Cup. Bonnie Berman joining you and sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper and hoping your day is a good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News. And we apologize to all you callers and emailers we couldn't get to. Thanks.